Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. The podcast is here for people on the open mic comedy circuit, whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, in fact, anybody who has any involvement in this industry. Even comedy fans who really do enjoy spending their evenings spent in pub basements watching possible stars of the future. Even better, if you want to join in on the open mic comedy circuit and you want to know what to expect, this is the podcast for you. My guest today is somebody I had the pleasure of seeing one of her very first gigs. It might have been a first gig and only been on the scene for a short while, but never seems to stop gigging at the moment. She's gone from open spots to paid gigs to being a guest MC, and she can pull chocolates from nowhere on the stage. Please welcome to the stage, Stacey Edwards.
Ooh, hello. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
A little tired, but still smiling. That's sounds about right for me. That's basically my mantra. Tired, but smiling.
How was that intro for you?
Yeah, it's fine. How did you feel?
I have been the receiver of one of those chocolates before, I remember.
Yeah. Yes, it was. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I don't really. I think I overthink stuff too much, which is I'm literally doing it as we talk right now. But I kind of found that stuff a bit gimmicky. So like it works really well, but I think it's more MC than like Type 5. So Booby Snacks hasn't been retired. She's just on the shelf for a little bit.
That's a little hint for anybody. If you want to find out what Booby Snacks are and you haven't seen Stacey, so you'll have to go and watch her at every single gig she does just to see if they return.
Just in case. I mean, chances are if you see me MC, they'll be coming out. I mean, you know. Not the boobies, but the snacks. Yeah.
Different kind of night out. Okay, so from the very beginning, how long have you been in comedy and how did you get started?
So it's been about 7 months, not counting my showcase that I did after I did the beginner's intensive course at the Bill Murray in April with Deck Monroe, legend. Shout out to Deck.
Okay.
I had always done... I basically hadn't done anything really performing for about 16 years, just a casual break, little hiatus of 15 years, 16 years. I studied theatre my whole way up through my school, through A-levels, did a drama degree, didn't do so great because I met a stupid boy, but that's a story for another time. No one understood. We loved each other so much. Turned out to be a bit of a waste of time. But I finished uni and was like, well, what am I going to do now? And I was like, maybe drama teaching. And then I was like, I hate children. So no. And then advertising it was, as it goes, and then into tech. And then towards the end of 2022, I found myself without a job because I don't know how familiar your listeners will be, but big tech did a lot of layoffs across the entire industry. And I was miserable, not going to lie. Mental health was in the bin. And I was like, I need to do something for myself. So I booked the Bill Murray course. And it's funny because I've always been really comfortable with getting up and performing characters or perform, like, you know, just doing karaoke. I've always been confident, but I was never confident presenting my work like in a business context. And I was like, well, if it's going to help with anything, it'll just help with that, you know. It'll make me better at interviews because I'll be able to think on my feet. And that I did the week-long course, and I remember on Wednesday of that week I was like, I'm definitely not performing on Sunday. And on Thursday, I was like, definitely not going to perform. Like, there's no way I'm going to remember this five. And then sort of started to run it on Saturday with my husband. And it was just in my head. Like, it just was all there, like planted. It was so weird. And then once you perform in front of a room of like 70 people that are all obviously there because they love the people that are doing the course. So it's an incredibly warm room in one of my favorite rooms where I've seen some of my favorite comedians do comedy. And that was kind of it for me. I was sold.
Okay, it's quite interesting because I think I've mentioned you're the ninth recording that we've done so far, and that's the, I think that's the fourth different course that somebody's been on. So it's showing that, especially around London anyway, there are a plethora of courses out there for people to pick and choose from.
Bill Murray.
Just to get into this, yeah.
Deck is brilliant. You know, Deck works with like the likes of Marwan Rizwan, Sophie Hagen, a whole bunch of other really exciting, groundbreaking comics that are doing, you know, immense work, storytelling, musical performance. I love it. And in terms of the reason why I got into comedy, I suppose, is because I love it. So when I was working in tech still, well, still am, but my last company, on the calls, the video calls, they'd always be like, you should do stand up. And I would always be like, no, I'm a better audience member. And really what got me into comedy was in like 2016, I started listening to the Guilty Feminist podcast. And I don't know if you've I don't know if you've listened to it, but it kind of bought.
I haven't.
You should. It's great. It's great. It opened the door for me to a podcasts, because now I'm like obsessed and I can't not have one on at any one time. I literally binge listened to the first two of yours.
Thank you.
And then also comedy, because it opened the door to people that I that have literally become my inspiration. So like my three favorite comedians are Felicity Ward, Jessica Foster Kew, and Susie Ruffle. And if it hadn't have been for those podcasters, those podcasts, I never would have found them. And they're all very storytelling based, which is, I think, sort of where my shtick is going.
Yes. Yeah. So how did the showcase actually turn out in the end after
really
your nerves
well.
Leading up to it?
It really well. I really didn't think it was going to. And then... But I was mainly fearful of not remembering. My probably my biggest comedy fear, and still is today, is getting up on stage and then having a mind blank and just be standing there while people are silently staring at you and you're silently staring at them. Because in like pub conversation, I'm witty and funny and I can think of things to say quite quickly, but it's very different when there's lights on you and, you know... Especially if you're trying a new bit or merging it onto the old bit. But it went so well. The room was so warm. Alexandra Haddo was the host, the MC, and she was great. It just went really well. And like then I heard you on another podcast if you was talking about this, where you do your first gig and it's like, wow. And then you go and do your second gig in like a small basement open mic room. And it's a very different vibe. And then you're like, oh, was that just a fluke?
I don't know if I said this on the first or which one I said it on, but I've said that if my second gig was my first gig, I would never have carried on.
Yeah, I can't remember. It might have been the one with Kim. I can't remember. I listened to them both in the same day.
It's a certainly a bit of a kick, but it's I do think as well though that the showcases that everyone says yes, it's nice and friendly and all of that, but ultimately 90% of the people in that room aren't there to see you.
No.
So if you can impress any of that 90%, then you've done a good job.
I didn't tell anyone that I was doing a showcase. I told people I was doing a course, but I wasn't like, everyone come watch me. I told one set of friends who came at the last minute, and I literally told them the day before and said, if you're free and you want to come, come. And they did.
Yeah.
And then we went and had lots of drinks afterwards. It was great.
So I didn't tell anyone. There was only one. Well, sorry, there's two people that knew I was doing the course. Even my own kids didn't know I was doing the course. My brother didn't know I was doing the course.
Right.
Only the friend that kind of pushed me into doing it, and the wife. And the only reason I told the wife was because if I was going out every Thursday night and not telling her where I was going, it would look somewhat suspicious.
Yeah, I can see that. I love how you refer to her as the wife.
I'm of that age, I think, where that's kind of been ingrained. It's kind of weird, I know.
My lovely, wonderful wife, who's so supportive. She's a good bra.
But yeah, I haven't got to the husband yet. I didn't tell anyone I was doing the course, and other than a friend and a wife. And then I think it was about a week before the showcase, I then said to the kids and my brother and a couple of friends, I said, I'm doing a bit of a stand-up comedy routine if you fancy coming here on this date. And they were like, you're doing what? Yeah. And yeah, it just went from there. But courses are the way in, I think.
Had you done performance before? Like, because I came with a foundation, so it was like my what's it called? Like when you, muscle memory. So when I went back on stage, suddenly I was like, oh, I feel like I'm doing drama again. I'm like, I'm in a black room, drugs. Like, obviously not actually drugs, but it's that kind of vibe. So it like switched on a whole side of my brain that I've like. Basically tried, I think, not tried to ignore, but tried to like keep quiet for a while. Like they say that your teens and your twenties, you're trying to like forget your child like yourself, and then in your thirties, and I'm 36. I know, she looks so young. I'm 36 and I think like I reconnected, and all of a sudden I'm like listening to Robbie Williams again. And all that sort of stuff from like when I was a kid.
Oh, brilliant. No, my background is nothing to do with performing at all. I'm so comfortable at work doing presentations, training courses. I've done training courses in front of 100, 200 people. Super comfortable in that kind of environment. Because I'm not trying to impress anyone. I'm just relaying information. And then it just got to me. It was like, a friend of mine said, me and a friend went to a open mic night as a kill time kind of thing. I didn't even know what an open mic night was, to be perfectly honest.
Isn't that what we're all doing, just killing time?
I made the stupid comment to him that said, I reckon I could give this a go. And then he kind of badgered me and said, you should. And I was like, well, how'd you do it? And I looked into it. And then, yeah, a year later, and somehow I'm still doing it. And this has happened.
So, I mean, I'm loving it. It's great. I feel very flattered to have been invited onto your show. I just want to point out that you've just directly contradicted yourself, that you said you didn't do performance and then you say you present in front of 100 to 200 people on the reg. I would argue that that is performance. Like, you know, people that don't perform are people that sit and do the IT side of things, or you know, they're making things at home and they're not. So it does. It's a muscle memory, and it's a level of comfort that if you can come to this craft, if that's what we can call it, with that sort of comfort with yourself and being in front of people, like that's I don't think you realize how important. Maybe you don't realize how important that could have been to the whole
evolution. I've never looked at it that way. I've always looked at it as I'm conveying messages to people, and I always try to have a little bit of a little bit of a laugh when it came to training courses and stuff. I always try to make mine different, so I try to make them entertaining. Which, when I look back, is possibly a performance part. Is that we used to have like these little sessions at work, like they called them lunch and learn. You go into the boardroom, familiar. You have 20 people, you talk about what you're doing. They put on a big spread for you. You do all of that. And I would get up, I would do my bit and say, oh, this is what I've been working on. This is how things have been going. This is all the new stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And then 5 minutes before the end, I'd say something along the lines of, so let's see who's paying attention. And I'd give them a quiz where they weren't expecting. But I was, every time an answer was correct, I'd just throw them a bag of Haribo or something like that.
Oh, very cool little of you.
Fun element. I was doing this years ago.
I always think it's amusing. Well, that's the thing. I've sat in those training sessions. Do you do this internally for your company, for a company you work for, or is the company you work for an external provider of trainings? Does that make sense?
No, it was within a company. I haven't done it for a few years that scenario, but yeah, it was within the company. So I was familiar with the people. It wasn't strangers.
Sometimes it's easier when it's strangers.
Yeah.
I think. Not in training, just in general. Like, I'm never more comfortable than in a room of complete strangers or in a room of people I know adore me. The people that I know half know me, they're the ones that I know have a kind of idea of what I am, and it's not always what I want them to think. So, because I might have just been on one that day that they met me, and they think, wow, she's crazy.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm in a quiet mood today. So.
I know what you mean, because I think sometimes if I go to a comedy night and it's not the whole bringer scenario and I'm there and there's other comedians that I know, I feel so much more comfortable than if I've got somebody there with me. It's very odd.
You mean a bringer, but, like a non-comic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I've got certain friends with me, it's a bit like, okay, because it's always that fear of going, so what did you think? What did you think? And then you try and gauge what they're honestly thinking rather than what's coming out of their mouth. And fortunate enough, most of the people I tend to socialize with will be relatively honest. But I do, I've had a couple of instances where somebody's gone, oh, you were really brave. It's like, all right. You've just basically said, yes, you were shit. But I admire you for getting on the stage, but that wasn't very good. Fair enough.
One of my comedy besties has a bit of material about how everyone says she's brave for doing what she's doing. And she's like,
yeah,
well, my like grandfather was in the war. Like, what's brave? Sorry, I'm stealing my friend's material here. I don't mean to. You should have her on. she's brilliant. But yeah, that's it. Like, we get told stuff like we're brave, or that, like, you know, oh, I never could, I never do it. And thinking, this was one of the things that Deck taught us actually in the course, was that one of the first steps was writing your pub story. I don't know if you did this in your course.
No.
Where it was like, write out a story that you would always tell at the pub to your friends to make them laugh, to engage them or whatever. And then we had to do it for like 2 minutes or whatever on the stage. And that was, so you kind of, if you're a person that's drawn to comedy, chances are you're a person that likes holding court at the pub.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it was that, it was playing into that. And so I think there are people that are naturally inclined. What I love is when I meet someone and I think I come across very obviously like I'm some sort of drama queen of some kind, like from talking to me for like 5 minutes, you're like, okay, she has ADHD and she's an only child and she was definitely a drama student. drugs. I love it when you meet the people that they surprise you. When I find I'm very much the same person on stage as I am off stage, and there are some people that's personas are completely different, even though they're not characters, and I find that quite fascinating.
Okay, so I guess that brings us into what's the best moment you've had on stage in your 60 gigs or so it's been.
That's a good question. That's the thing someone always says when they're stalling for an answer. That's a good question, or they repeat it. What's my favorite moment from a gig? I think my showcase to start off with, because if that hadn't gone, like you said, if that hadn't gone well, or if I'd got up on stage and I'd forgotten it all, it was because like that would have probably been like, you know, the air would have gone out of my balloon. But because I proved to myself that I could remember it, and I used to learn lines, you know, the whole way going through my education. So, but I thought it part of my brain that like switched off, that I couldn't do it anymore. So that, I did a really good G&B gig once.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do them that often because I find bringers quite, I'm having a break off bringers at the moment, basically. I'm trying to just, I'm working on material. I'm working more on like the writing and the storytelling, so that just saying it in front of people anywhere, I don't really care where I say it. Just ask my friends. They wish I'd shut up. so there was a really good G&B gig once where, I don't know if you were even, you might have been there, but just the audience came with me and they loved it and it was great.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite gigs is also Queer Comedy Club. It is the most... Have you done Queer Comedy Club?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, it's very welcome for allies, etc.
Yeah.
And it's just the loveliest, most warm room. Like, David Ian, who does the emceeing, is just so good at it. And whenever I've done emceeing, like, he's the person I think of and be like, what would David Ian do?
Yes.
I'm trying to think of, like, the best ones, because there's always something that I'll find wrong with it.
Yeah.
Somewhere, even if
it doesn't have to be
good.
The perfect performance. It can just be the one that you've got, you've come off stage and gone, yeah, that's done it. That's the box ticked. I've done the best that I could have done that night. And
oh, I have one.
The audience were happy.
So it was my first out of town, first paid gig, actually. So my Hannah Brackenbury, who is a very gifted musical comic who has been going for 10 plus years, I think. She's based in Worthing, near Brighton, and she hosts Funny Girls Worthing. And I was invited down to do a 7, and I did my 7 in front of an entire room of only lesbians, pretty much. So the boob jokes went down great. There was one guy, Sally Ann Fellows was headlining, and she had brought a guy. I'm not sure who he was. But yeah, it was just a great room. And like, I just felt so welcomed and warmed, and it was like a big hug. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different vibe playing like that out of the norms, if you will, gigs to the like comic gigs, like the gigs that are mainly comics. It makes a big difference. And I sort of think that my shtick is more meant for rooms of norms. Forgive me calling them norms. I don't know what else to use. The general public.
Yeah.
To rooms of comedians.
Yes.
I don't know.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So the flip side to that, we've all had them. The worst one.
Oh.
You always remember the worst one.
Oh, yeah. That one. I have. It's funny, right? So this is something I actually wrote down to discuss, was that I almost always think I'm bombing while I'm up there. Almost always.
Yeah.
Because unless I'm hearing big guffaw laughs, like big laughs, I just assume everyone's not laughing. But I'm also a very loud laugher in the audience, as I'm sure you are aware.
Yep.
And so as soon as I get on stage, that big loud laugh that's mine isn't there anymore because it's on the stage.
Yes.
And so I think my big loud laugh gives people the cover to laugh loud as well. Like, it makes them, or they're laughing at me because my laugh is so stupid. So if I go on stage and I don't hear these big guffaws, I think it's going really bad. Thank God for filming yourself, honestly, because then you can watch it back and be like, oh no, there's laughs. They're just not ridiculously over dramatic laughs because they're not you, Stace, in general. But yeah, so my worst gig, I won't say where it was because I don't want to do any discredit to the promoter because he was nice.
Yeah.
But I was the only woman on the bill. The only other woman in the audience was my dear comedy colleague, Sarah Conrad, who's also very good. She'd come along with me. It wasn't a bringer. She just came along to watch. And I got up on stage and crickets. It was like they hated me. I've never had a reaction like that before. I was got off and I was so in my head. I nearly cried. Like, I don't know. But then when I listened to the other comics jokes, I was like, oh, right. We're in like, let's just say it was the kind of night where I'm used to doing, where a white guy gets on stage. No offense. A white guy gets on stage and for 5 minutes pretends he's going to drop the N-bomb and then doesn't. And I'm like, please don't.
Yeah.
But also, where's the funniness? Where's the clever observation of whatever it is that you're talking about? Or there's like just some casual transphobia that doesn't have. I think if you're going to try and be an edgelord, you actually have to be one, or instead of just dancing near it. So I can understand why they didn't get my shtick, because it's only poking fun at me, myself. I'm my my comedy is like storytelling, self-deprecation.
Yeah.
Slash, I come across like a kids' TV presenter, and I just don't think it was their vibe.
Fair enough.
Here's one I made earlier. So that was hard. And the other one was I had forgotten that there was like a competition at the end.
Okay.
And I had to go on and do a minute's improv about, I was just given cornflakes, and I'd had too much to drink in between my gig set, which was in the first half and the end, and I'd completely forgotten. And I just started listing the stuff I put in my porridge. It's not funny. I'm like, dried raspberries, dried blueberries. It's like, everyone's like, where's the joke? And I'm like, please let this stop.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So you touched there on you had a sort of extra competition at the end. I know we both took part in a GMB new act night once. I remember. Have you done any others?
So I've done the Cavendish Arms with the clap off.
Yeah.
And I was in the clap off, but the guy that was also in it with me, I think personally deserved to take the clap. Whatever. That was the clap. That's not what I meant. He deserved the clap and I didn't. No. and I did the one they do at Soprano.
Yes.
Which one is that?
Yeah, Big Nose Comedy.
Big Nose, that's it. So this actually might be considered my worst gig. The actual performance was fine. But on my way to the gig, I was cycling on Tottenham Court Road and I went to turn in to a road to cut round the back of Oxford Street because no one wants to cycle on Oxford Street. And a man who was in the middle of the road, instead of getting out of the way, I slowed down, but instead of getting out of the way, he froze.
He
sort of caught my bike, like by the handlebars. And I was just like immediately like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like the brakes aren't amazing on these, but also why did you freeze in the middle of the road?
Yeah.
And he pulls his fist back like he's going to punch me in the face.
Oh.
And a man, a person that was mask presenting anyway, was like, what are you doing? And like starts to like get in. And then suddenly there's all these people. And this guy is like still sort of holding. And then he ends up punching this other guy. And I then had to go and do a gig. And Jonathan Stadlin was there, who I did my course with. He's a good friend of mine now, comedy colleague. He's great. He's really good to learn from us to how to run shows. I teched for his show just before Christmas. Really sound production value. And I'm glad he was there because it made me feel a little bit safer, but my brain sort of went into survival mode. I was like, I've just got to get my set out, and then I can just chill. And I was like, please can I go in the first half? Please can I go as soon as possible? Like, I need to get it done. But then there was a clap off, and like when I didn't win the clap off, like Nick Kay won it. He's great. I took it so hard, but it was because I'd already finished my comedy bit, and I was starting to process the like kind of horrific thing that happened to me, an hour or so before, a few hours before. So doing comedy when you're kind of in traumatized shock is probably it's probably my winner for the loser gig. But the actual performance was fine, went fine. People laughed. I didn't get gonged off or whatever. It's barely a gong show, is it? Like you don't normally, I don't think.
No.
So yeah,
no,
sorry,
it is the answer. That's what this is about. This is the truth and the answer. So whether the answer is 10 minutes long or 30 seconds long, it's still the answer.
I have long answers. I never have short answers. Concise isn't really a strength of mine. I am going to go up to Manchester at some point and hopefully do Beat the Frog because I've heard that's quite nice. And I'm doing the first West End new act heat on the 12th of Feb. So basically if I get through that, then I might start gonging potentially. But I'm like Chris with what he was saying about not wanting to rush through. You know, he was saying that he waited a long time to progress from his, his 5 to his 7 and his 7 to his 10. And I've got to the 7 now, but people keep booking me for 10s and I keep being like, I've got 10, but it's not my seven is slamming, but I've got 10.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can, you know, that's when the boob snacks come back.
Yes.
They make a reappearance.
gongs are an interesting one, but I think they are, you need a little bit of a thick skin for them. And you need to be quite well prepared. If you're willing just to go and go, hey, give it a shot. If it doesn't work, I can brush it aside, then it's fine, go for it. But I think if there's any point of view where you think, how am I going to feel if it doesn't quite go to plan? Leave it until you're a bit more ready.
Yeah, I mean,
comes from a man that's been burnt recently. So,
oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I've done two. One went well, didn't pass, but one nearly got to the end, and one pretty much got off straight away. And it was just, yeah, it wasn't the greatest feeling for the next couple of days after. And you start, if you're the sort of person that stews things over in their mind a lot, has big bouts of insomnia, leave it until you're a bit more prepared.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's the audience, right? So like the day that you got on, mm-hmm. they decide what they think about you. Apparently you decide what you think about someone in like a microsecond of seeing them. Like your brain decides like friend, foe, like cool, not cool, like judging their social status and everything. And, you know, if you have also I think with gong shows, it's quite a like bro-y laddie vibe in the audience. Often
it can be, yeah.
And you know, sometimes they don't find jokes about boobs funny. They like talking about them.
The one that I was at, there was three females that went up in the first half, and I saw them go up, and I just thought, you're not going to last. You're just not going. The audience is those people that have got the cards they're just not going to go for you. And I think most of them got halfway through and then they were gone. And
a grace period one or not a grace period one?
Yeah, it's a grace period. So you get 2 minutes and then and then it's a free for all after that. And yeah, there was three females that got on and they were all very, very good. And you could tell they were getting a few laughs here and there and they were building up to something. But then, I don't know, there was just something in the crowd that just didn't feel like it was going to be favourable to them. Because I don't know if it was all three people with the card in the first half were male. I don't know if that was a factor.
I mean, they really shouldn't allow that, but in my opinion.
No, they actually changed the cards in the second half to two females and a male because so few people got through in the first half. They said, this is getting ridiculous. We don't want everyone going through, but we need people to go through.
Yeah. Well, it's that joke, isn't it, that matters? It's like getting
it's
out there.
It's an interesting one.
Don't do a lead, don't do a build-up. Like, tell a couple of jokes and then tell a story. So, like, you know, strong opening. That seems to be important.
It's almost, you don't, the ones that I found, the ones with a grace period, you don't need a strong opening.
Because you've got
the grace
period.
A good opening, granted.
You need a strong middle.
Your strong bit needs to come at the point that they can start getting rid of you. So if you can have people laughing at that point, you should be safe. That was my thinking, and it completely backfired. I had the whole, probably front two-thirds of the audience laughing at a sentence when the lights went to say, this is your 2 minutes up, now it's a free-for-all. And it went card, card, card straight away. And I was on the stage going, really? And when everybody's laughing, but those three... something didn't twig, or they'd made their mind up, or they hadn't listened to what I said just before. And it went horribly wrong against me. But we
some
live and learn. I've got
like
over
bouncers.
It. I've done a better gig since.
Yeah. Some of them could be, you know how like bouncers, I know it sounds weird, but like bouncers and security guards sometimes get a little bit power mad, where they're like, you can come in, but you're too drunk and you to do it. Like, I feel like some people probably enjoy having the power to do that. And so it kind of sounds like in that scenario specifically, that perhaps there were people that were just like, I can, so I will. Ha ha. Like, you know.
I think there was a bit of that.
Yeah.
There was always, I think, out of everybody in the first half, there was always somebody that put the card up within 30 seconds of them being able to.
What were they expecting? Like, were they expecting like Billy Connolly to pop out and run around?
Not a clue.
Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's an interesting one, but it's one of those situations where you just if you've got the thick skin for it, go for it. I would suggest to others, and I don't know if this is actually, I think I've seen Tash Klusky do this recently.
Tash is so
I think
good.
She went up and she did a Beat the Frog recently, but I think she combined it with lots of other gigs in the north.
She did, yeah.
So if anybody, I think, especially from London, is new, the thing I would advise is to tie it in with other gigs in the same kind of area that you can do, because you don't want that chance of going on Beat the Frog, for example, it not going well, and then that's it. You've travelled all the way to Manchester for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, whatever it is. Whereas if you can then jump on another open mic gig somewhere in the next couple of nights and make a bit more of a thing of it, I think that makes it more worthwhile for you.
That's literally what I'm in the middle of planning right now.
Good.
I, me and some other comedy females, peeps, women, whatever you want to call, are going to ship up in my car. I've got a little Yaris. I was going to drive us up and hopefully we can find some accommodation to share and do the frog, but then also do some other gigs so that, you know, we go like for, you know, like a Wednesday to like a Saturday or something. So then we also have like a trip where we have a nice time, and so that you've got like a unit of people and they're all people I like and that I know will all get on. So it's the same way as I want to go to the Fringe this year. I don't actually want to go. I started madly like researching stuff and I'm already like, it's going to be so expensive to stay there, which I know you talked about with Kim and
Chris.
But yeah, I actually want to go with some non-comedy people so I can be like, we're just going for a long weekend. And then I just hop on a couple of open spots so that it's just like very low stakes. I thrive in low stakes.
Yeah. And I think it's also good if you're in Edinburgh, especially if you've never been before, taking some of the more touristy stuff that's not Fringe and not comedy related.
I've been a couple of times as a punter. I've been once on a hen do where we were supposed to see three or four things, but trying to gather 14 women and getting them all to move around the Fringe. We ended up just, you know, it would be like, oh, should we go? Oh, I just got a pint. Oh, okay. Oh, well, all right, we'll go now. Oh, no, she's in the loo. And you just end up staying in the same place for like 3 hours. And you're like, okay. And then I went back the following year with my husband in 2018. And I just dragged him round the lineup from Guilty Feminist, basically. I was like Cindy V, Susie Ruffle, like Jen Brister. That was the year Rose Matafeo won Best Newcomer, I think. Just dragged him round to all these women comedians. And I had a great time, but I never thought I would be going up there as a performer. I never thought, you know, when I was at school and we did like the drama class, everyone was like, we're going to the Fringe. We're taking this to the Fringe. And that was a very different type of Fringe. So I didn't really understand comedy in the Fringe until I started liking comedy. And in terms of liking comedy, I mean, everyone enjoyed like Michael McIntyre's Mandrill, right? Like, but that's what I thought comedy was. I didn't really realize that there was the space for people like me. Like, you know, unless you're like Joe Brand or Sarah Millican, you know, I know things have changed a lot in the last decade or so in terms of like representation for women, representation for like LGBT plus people that are not men, you know. So it's a totally different world now, and it's exciting.
it is exciting. It's a fun place to be. And I went to the Fringe for the first time last year and I thought it was great. There is I think the organization up there in terms of the city is everything's walkable, but everything's a pain in the backside to find.
Oh yeah,
I think they need to. Uh, I, th- I think they need to color code areas. For example, if you're in venue 264, don't assume venue 265 is a stone's throw away.
No.
It could be miles away. And you need to know that, okay, I want to watch A, B, or C, and they're in the green area, which is a half mile segment radius. Okay, I can stay there. I can book the tickets for one after another. Because we actually went to see Gail Porter with the intention of going to see Josh James after.
Right.
And there was like a 35 minute gap between the two. And it worked out there was going to be like a 10-15 minute walk between the two, which is fine. But then Gail Porter's late.
Right.
And doesn't finish until 10 minutes before Josh James is about to start. You're like, we can't do that. That one's just been wasted. I've wasted money on those tickets now. But there was no way we were going to get there. Just Uber? It couldn't happen.
Uber doesn't work during the Fringe, basically.
It was all within like a pedestrianized area. So yeah. It was kind of like, yeah, you never get, if you get an Uber, you're better off walking. So it just couldn't happen. It was just too far away and you'd end up walking in probably 5-10 minutes into his set. And it just, I'd hate doing that. So I just leave it. So you get things like that where you have to be pragmatic about it and be realistic and make sure that things are 5 minutes away from each other, just in case there is a problem.
But, that sounds like a spreadsheet that I would definitely have, because I'm pretty type A mum vibes when it comes to planning. I mean, my job is literally being a project manager during the day. One of my favorite things I did at the Fringe, and I don't know if they still do it, but it's Silent Disco walking tour. It's so fun. If you're there this year.
I saw it. I didn't take part.
It's so fun. It's so fun. I love it. They do them in London as well. And the first time I did it, it was like only in Edinburgh, and it was back in 2017, I think, actually.
Yeah.
And you went around a lot. They've got a lot more restrictions on them now, I think, as to where they went. We just literally went everywhere. We're like dancing and singing along. We were with a Hindu, so like it was vibes. And the guy that was taking us around was in this tiny little gold spandex shorts thing, like Mr. Motivator vibes. It was so fun. I know that's not comedy related, but if you want something fun to do that's not comedy, that you can just go and let loose with friends, I thoroughly recommend doing it. I don't remember the company name. I just know it's a Silent Disco walking tour. They haven't asked me to promote them.
No, we saw that walking towards us at one point and didn't know what it was and was like, what the hell
Flash mob.
Is going on?
Yeah. Do you remember when flash mobs were like a huge thing back in like 2012, 2013, where people would just be on, it'd be the overground, and then out of nowhere someone would start singing, and then like this guy would propose to his girlfriend. Like, that's how I wanted to be proposed to. And I was like, but it's so not my husband's vibe. That's how I would propose to someone, I think. Yeah.
That would be DJ. So you've made the way into doing some guest MC spots as well. So how have you found that transition, and when was your first one?
My first MC spot was with Square Go. Thank you, Imran, for having me to host. Mm-hmm. And actually, funnily enough, with Chris. So Imran runs Square Go bi-weekly on a Saturday in a blighty cafe in Finsbury Park. It's an interesting venue, but it's a good night. Mm-hmm. And he invites guest MCs, and he does it so that if he's MCing, he'll take the first or second half and then the other person. So you've got two MCs, which actually is quite nice because it almost feels a bit more like you're hosting a night. But he was at the Fringe, funnily enough, when my first MC was. And me and Chris Alley were the two co-MCs for the night. And I actually knew Chris from before doing comedy, like when he used to work in a charity, and I used to volunteer for this charity. And when we met at TNT, he's like, I really know you. And then he was like, we figured out that we'd known each other from like a previous life. And so I felt quite safe in his hands, which was nice. But it's nerve-wracking, because you're like, what's the balance of material that I should do versus the like setup of the night, and like, do I need to set it all up at the beginning or should I set it up as I go? Because often, especially that gig, sometimes the audience changes quite considerably from the first half to the second half, because like locals literally turn up. And so if you're setting up the night at the front end, don't assume that those people will be the same by the end. So you kind of have to set it up again. But yeah, I was nervous. I held a notepad the entire time. I looked like I was coordinating a house move. I was holding like this thing. I mean, like, right, have I done this? My most fearful thing was making sure I said everyone's names right. I hate it when people just guess a name. I think it's really awful. I think that's like the most basic thing you can do as an MC is to go up and talk to all of the acts and make sure that if they have a name that seems at all ambiguous to your how to say it, make sure that you say it correctly. And actually, I had several people come up to me after that gig and say thank you so much. And also, I was very careful not to use terms like ladies and gentlemen and trying to just use like beautiful humans and to try and be as diverse as I could, because I think that if the MC makes the room comfortable, then even if the acts kind of are on the line of, you know, maybe alluding to any sort of isms towards people, you know, it makes them feel safe. And I have had people tell me that. So that's nice. I think I foster a warm room. But if Chris hadn't, if Chris hadn't been there for me to be like, what am I supposed to do now? Is this right? You know, like just checking like what was happening next. It would have been a lot more scary. So it felt nice to have him there, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. So you're doing a few more as well, I assume.
Yeah, so I've done, my biggest NC is probably Comedy Cabin, a Raw. I mean, the Comedy Cabin Raws, love Ashi, she's so great. It's usually comics mainly on a Sunday afternoon. Yep. And there'll be a couple of like people that, you know, general members of the public that come on. And I did this whole, I can make balloon animals.
Okay.
So I used to work at Legoland in entertainments because I told you I'm a kids TV presenter at heart. And I decided to make it a part of the emceeing. And it sort of wrapped around some of my material and I like invited people up. And actually it didn't work great because it just takes too long for people to, you know, so I think I find emceeing really fun to like try stuff that I will never fit into my 5 or my 7 because that's a story. Whereas the emceeing, you can like do little bits here and there, you know, like, oh, like every comic, let's talk about how we got here. Like, was it the tube? What do you do with your eyes on the tube? Do you make eye contact? Do you stare the thing? Do you look at the floor? Do you accidentally rest on someone's crotch because they're standing directly in front of you? Usually that's it. And then I'll suddenly be like, I'm staring at someone's crotch. Jesus, where do I look? but yeah. And then I'm emceeing TNT at the end of the month. Cool. Which, as we all know, is a long night. Have you done TNT?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I've done
TNT. It's a long
TNT.
Night. But Sama is so nice. And I think she's really eager to get more female acts because I've never seen a female MC there. I'm doing that. But that I will keep tight. I'm going to just do like the 5 minutes. And then I'm just going to do 5 minutes. And then the rest of the time I'll probably just be, let's keep the acts going. Because she runs a tight ship. Like it needs to finish by the time it's supposed to finish. And so, as you've seen, I can talk for quite a while. But yeah.
So you've touched on the kind of, I guess as part of an MC, you kind of write on the fly.
Yeah.
So kind of like taking that step back into it doesn't have to be your best joke, but your favorite joke and how you came up with it. And has it changed over time?
My favorite joke is when I first met my husband, we had that kind of love that can take your breath away. And then I follow up with, quite literally for me, I had a panic attack the first time I saw his asshole. And that always does well. That always does well. People always find it funny. And it's true. It's genuinely true. A lot of my jokes that I write, a lot of my stories that I tell that I hope are funny are based in truth. I might take them and like bend them and make them a bit bigger than they actually were just for the, you know, the caricature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's my favorite joke. And I've recently been following up with, I don't know whether to scream at it or blow on it to see if it will retreat. But I haven't worked on the, I have to work on the delivery of it a little bit because it's still in that craft stage. But that one always works. And because my general set is all around the fact that I have one fake boob, that's that's comedy gold. Like, you know, it was awful when I was a teenager, but now it just gives you so much material that my entire seven is about that, and my entire 10 will be about that. I just need to find new angles. And a friend of mine who's been doing comedy for quite a long time, his name's Alex Camp. I've known him for years and years and years from, he used to be in a band and I was a little bit of a groupie from Brighton.
Okay.
And I, Sarah Kayworth, they were doing a bit about the fact that their mum has one impeccable tit because the mum has had breast cancer and had to have it replaced. And I sent this to him and I was like, they're doing my stuff and like, they're doing it better. It's always difficult when you see your material that you kind of think is yours. And it's not like I'm doing generic stuff about bottomless brunch or dating or the tube or that sort of thing. It's very personal to me, you know, this story. And I sent this to him and I said, you know, does this mean I can't do this now? And he was like, no, but send me. And I sent him my seven alongside and he watched it. And he said, you know, what you're doing is a funny performance, but I think you're missing the, like, the juice. That's the wrong word. The niche part here is like, what was it like waiting for your boob to come? Like, what was that? Yeah. What was that like? And I was like, oh my God. And it just revolutionized my writing. And I now come at it from a lot. I'm now like looking for more of the funny in like really sort of going back and trying to remember what it was like, remember the things that made me really feel that way about that. And then finding the funny in that. And that's been so powerful, for me in my writing. And I've loved exploring it. And I have like, you know, endless note files on my phone. More stuff about boobs. And it's just like random lines because I'll be going to sleep and it'll be like, da 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 da. And then you're like, oh, okay, better turn over and write this now. I can't remember stuff. Like, I can't think of stuff and then hold it. It's gone. I have to write it down immediately or it's gone.
I'm very much similar kind of vein on things like that. And it's, if you look through the notes on my phone, you'd think I'm an extremely disturbed person. Because none of it is just one line of things. And they don't make any sense. But it reminds me of something that happened. To put in context, I've got a line in my notes that says, too early for a wank. Out of context, that means nothing to anyone. But it means everything to a story involving a mate coming down from Newcastle to see me in London. We're walking through Leicester Square and I said, what do you want to do? And I jokingly went, oh, gentleman's club. And he went, no, it's too early for a wank. And that line just made us, that was it. We were in hysterics for the rest of the afternoon. And it's there, it's parked, and it will come out at some point. But it has to come out in the right way. And I haven't worked out the right way, but it's there. At some point, it will find its way coming out of my mouth onto a stage.
I guess it needs to fold into a wider story, right? I always find folding into a wider story like that as that it's the premise is very funny, but it's like the end of a story as opposed to like a one-liner joke. You know, I was watching a show on Thursday, and in the middle of it, because I. This is an overshare, so sorry. But when you're first, so the context is that when you're first dating someone, at least when I was, and I've been with my husband for 11 years, so this is so not a problem anymore. But you pretend that you don't fart.
Yes.
You pretend that that's not a thing that you do. And I, for some reason, that on Thursday at the show, I was like, I needed to fart quite a lot, but I didn't. I held it all in, and I was in the audience of this show, and a storytelling show, and I could feel, you know, when you can feel them going off inside, like fireworks just inside your stomach, and you're like, and you can still sort of hear them, but in a different way. And I just wrote down, let me just read exactly what I wrote, because it's so silly. I wrote down, holding in farts and then feeling them go off inside of you. And that's all I've written. That's it. That's all that's there. And I was like, this is funny. I don't know why it's funny or how, but it's funny. But it's part of something that rolls in to, you know, into another joke somewhere at some point that, you know, I talk about my husband's arsehole.
It becomes an anecdote for
a follow-up joke somewhere, you know. And that's what I love the most about writing is when, I don't know if you have this, but like, suddenly out of nowhere, it just kind of flows out of me and I write everywhere all the time. And sometimes I'll go a couple of weeks without thinking of anything. And then out of nowhere, I'll be like, it just flows. And then I look through like the little bits of jokes I have to see if anything else folds in.
Yeah.
But writing is easy. It's the practicing that takes the time. I have a full-time job. It's also kind of cringy. I have to kind of go in the bedroom and do it on my own. I don't want to do it in front of my husband. It feels weird.
Film
myself always. Filming myself is always, I just love looking at myself. Listening to your own voice messages. Like, I don't think anyone enjoys anything more than listening to their own voice messages that they've sent on WhatsApp. Just imagine how many times I'm going to listen to this podcast when you put it out. It's just going to be on repeat. Like, I'm just going to be like, and anyone comes over, I'll be like, oh, just pop a podcast on. It's like, oh, it's just convenient. You got me in it.
So I've recently spoken to a friend of yours who I believe she mentioned that you two are, I'm not sure if it's in collaboration with other people, are creating your own female orientated comedy night. Is that fair?
I'd say it's a non-male oriented as opposed to a female oriented, because I don't want to be turfy about it. That's definitely not what we're here for. So yes, it's me and Emmy, and then Charisse Johnson, who actually is the one who does the just to give her a shout out, she's the one who does the material about being brave. For doing comedy, being told she's brave, and then Joy Harvey as well, and we're all at different stages. Like Emmy and Joy have been going for quite a lot longer. I've been going for a little bit. Joy, Charisse is still quite early on. We all have fairly grown up jobs in the week, so it's been really fun and exciting to collaborate. And we have our WhatsApp group, and it's not just talking about that all the time. It's like, I had this date, this happened, and it's really fun. Like, it's just become this really lovely group of women. But yeah, so we are promoting a non-male forward, semi-pro, bottomless comedy brunch that will happen monthly. Now, the comedy isn't bottomless, just to be clear. There is like an hour of bottomless drinks before the comedy. It's not all non-male. We're having like one slot per show where we will ask a guy to come in, and we will have guys headlining. We just want to promote a heavy non-male lineup just to offset most other comedy shows.
Turn the tables a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, and don't hold me to it. Like one week, 1 month, we might have more than one, you know, non-cis male, again, just want to be clear, sorry, using my diversity. It's just nice. We want to just hear those people. I once did a gig at Comedy and Beyond, and it was 10 acts and 9 women and 1 guy. And that guy was wearing a skirt. So it felt like I had to up my game, actually, because they were all so good. Everyone was so good. Yeah. And it was such a nice thing to see just for once, you know. I'm not saying it can't always be like that. Oh. There's just way more male comedians than there are female comedians and non-binary comedians. But it's nice when it happens occasionally, you know.
I think it's a good thing. I really do. It's I don't think anyone should be afraid or ashamed of saying this is the night they want to create. If you want to create a night that's completely opposite, you go ahead and create a night that's completely opposite.
Yeah.
It's when you get people on, especially on social media, and you get somebody that, I don't know, does something against a group of people and says, oh, but you wouldn't report your own people for doing this. Well, why don't you do that then?
Yeah.
Don't, if you want change, be the change you want to change.
Yeah.
Don't interfere in other people's work if that's what they want to do. Somebody wants to create an all female night, they can create an all female night.
Yeah.
No, exactly. You can turn it off. Are you going to go? Realistically, would you go? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
You do what you want to do and promote what you want to promote.
Yeah. Well, that's it there. Like, so it's very much not a new material vibe either. So, it's going to be that norms crowd that I was talking about, as opposed to other comedians. Yeah. Comedians will, we're looking for semi-pro comedians with like one or two shorter spots for like people more at my level. Like, I wouldn't be up there doing 10, 15. I'm really excited about like producing it and running the tech and doing that sort of stuff, because actually I'm a bit of a dork for it, even though you wouldn't know, because my husband had to help facilitate this setup so much for this podcast. But yeah, so it's going to be called Candy Store. And we're hopefully launching at the end of this month, at the end of January, for our first gig on the 2nd of March at Dabbers Bingo in Hackney. And the venue is so cool. And it's like 5 or 6 acts, and we're also going to prioritize having a non-comedy act as well, so like a burlesque or like drag, or which I suppose drag is comedy, depending on the type of drag, I guess. But yeah, because we don't just want to have a lineup of comedians, we want to have something as well that's like a bit different and a bit more jazz hands, for lack of a better describe a word.
It's cool. It should be interesting.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. And like, we're working on all our branding and stuff at the moment. And so when that comes through, it's going to be, at the moment, it still seems just like a WhatsApp group. And so once we've got all the branding, it's going to be real. And like, once we can launch on Instagram and all of that sort of stuff. So if you have any hints on how to market things, just let us know.
preparation.
Yeah,
is what I've learned, especially through
fortunately
this.
That's my forte.
I've actually had the idea for this podcast in my brain probably since about August, and it took me ages to actually go, right, I can do this. And I wasn't sure if I could do it. I got to a point of thinking, would I ever have people on there? Can I ask questions? Can I convey a message? And then it just got to the point where I've just got to do it. And the moment I'm using some software like Canva or something for my own comedy stuff on Instagram, I just started doodling like little logos and stuff. And it's like, okay, this is becoming real when you don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start thinking about schedules, consistency, and all of that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's the preparation side that then forces you to make something happen.
I have like little ideas that sometimes they get off the ground, and other, like I have all these like video sketch ideas, but the idea of the amount of prep I'd have to do to, like, I know some people just pick up a phone and just do it, but I'm like, no, I'd want to storyboard it, and I'd want to like create the narrative arc of whatever it is I'm trying to say. And I just don't have the time. So I would love to start my own podcast, but I don't have the time, along with work. And then now doing this show, you got to pick your battles. And I was like, that doesn't mean I could never, because, you know, once we've got this show set up, we're hoping, you know, it will just be us, you know, in between, now that we've got it all, going to get it all done, it'll just be a case of booking the act, most of which we're approaching directly, as opposed to having like a sign up sheet.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then being there to make sure that the show goes okay, you know, and there's 4 of us, so we don't have to be at every, not each one of us has to be at every show. So
yeah,
that might free up a bit of time, but I love taking on too much onto my plate, and then then basically the plate just falls and smashes, and then I cry.
Yeah, I think that's, before I started this, I asked probably around about 6 people I knew on the open mic circuit if they would be interested in appearing. And the thing was, if 5 say yes, then there's something in it to do.
Yeah.
If there's only 1 or 2, then it's probably not a goer.
And, you asked a comic if they wanted spotlighting and they said yes, and you're surprised.
I know, it sounds ridiculous, but it's that confirmation in my head.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost like the, it's not even just the, would you want to appear on a podcast? It's, would you want to appear on a podcast with me?
Well, you're very nice.
That, and having
you
that
were supportive off
that,
the bat
okay,
with me.
This is something.
Yeah.
Well, you're, that's the other thing. That was actually one thing I was going to say was that, because I don't know how many gigs you've done when I first met you. Because
I think that
it
was my fourth gig.
I knew it was really low.
Yeah.
And for me, I think it was only about my 10th as well, 10th or 11th. And I'm still in that green phase of, I want to talk to people and learn from people. And I think for me personally, one of the nicest things is when somebody comes up to you completely out of the blue and just says, that was really good. And you know they mean it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ones that really perturb me is when you go up to somebody and say, oh, I really enjoyed your set. And they go, oh, and yours.
Oh, but, God, I know.
Yeah, you didn't listen.
It's like you've only
you're only
the
saying
room.
That as a compliment to go back. Because I did a gig on Wednesday. And some fella came up to me whilst I sat at the bar at halftime. I'd done my set. And he said, Mark, that was really good. I really enjoyed that. I was just like, okay. I recognize you, but I can't think where from. And he was an act, and he got up and did his bit. And I was like, as soon as he said a particular line, I was like, yes, I remember you now. But it was nice that somebody came up to me to say, I really enjoyed it. But they actually used my name as well.
Yeah.
They remembered the name from just, it's that nice thing.
Familiarity.
It's that taking care and attention and supportive. Yeah.
Belonging. And, I mean, that's all we're looking for. We're pack animals, after all. You know, we move in tribes. We're comedians are just one big tribe, like sometimes exhausting tribe, but we're all one big tribe. And there's various different sects of that tribe. No, I've recently been socializing with comedians more, like after gigs or, you know, whatever, just in general. Yeah. And especially if everyone's drinking, it feels like it can be quite exhausting. And I mean that in the most loving, wonderful way.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way that I think a lot of people find me a bit exhausting. Because I feel like I'm always doing material, like no matter what. Even before I did comedy, I think I look back and I'm like, I was always doing material. I was always trying to make people laugh, make people like me, and make people think I'm interesting. And that's what comedy is. Maybe some people don't care about making them like you, but like, being interesting and making them laugh. That's the whole thing of it, right? So comedians get off stage, but they carry on going. And sometimes it can feel like we're all just waiting our turn to do our 5 in a group.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was out the other night and one person was like really, really chatty in a way that I literally couldn't get a word in. And part of me was like, oh, this is tiring because I feel like I should say something, but I can't. And then I was like, but wait, you don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
You can just be quiet. You don't have to entertain anyone. You can just be here and that's fine. And then suddenly I was like, oh, no, this is actually really nice. And I just sort of sat and listened and nodded and didn't feel like I had to fight my way in. And that was quite nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely it's definitely a community. And for the most part, it is a supportive community as well that I've found.
Yeah.
And I think the more support people give, it just makes it nice and friendly and welcoming. And doing what we do, as we've always been told, I couldn't do that. It looks really scary. It's actually not scary.
You're so
when
brave.
You're comfortable and you just get there.
Yeah.
But let's flip this to a little bit of fun.
Sure.
For this. So a common question I've asked everybody so far is the day you become super famous, you're about to walk out and record your live at the Apollo special in Hammersmith in front of 5,000 people. What do you choose as your walk-on music?
I was thinking about this after I heard you ask this question. It's so funny. I never think of that as a goal. Like my goal as a comedian is to get good enough that I get asked to go to a music festival that I'd already have wanted to go to and I can camp in a slightly nicer area. That's like my goal, which I think is not too lofty. But the music I would walk out to, I think my auto response is like Stacey's Mum, but that doesn't really represent me. It's just because my opening joke used to be, "Hi, I'm Stacey. You might already know me from that song about my mum." That's a good MC opener. That's always my MC opener. Probably. So I like big music that makes you want to jump around. So my favorite band are Muse. I like Queen, like Lizzo. So, oh, you know what? At the moment, it would be "Let Me Entertain You" by Robbie Williams, because I'm obsessed with listening to Robbie Williams at the moment. I can't stop. Keep putting it on all the time.
Okay.
And you know that feels appropriate as well. For the venue. my time on the stage. I'm doing live next to the Apollo next week. That's a gig that my friend Jonathan runs. Listed. Yeah. So I'm almost there. Just like almost. You know, half a mile away.
They're cool though. Robbie Williams, "Let Me Entertain You."
Yeah.
Cool, cool choice.
Such a such big dick energy song. It's such a good song.
Yeah. So kind of back to the open mic-y kind of stuff. If you've got somebody that's come up to you after a few gigs and asked for a little bit of help, what's the one tip you would give them?
Probably the one thing I can't do, which is don't overthink it. I really love workshopping stuff. So actually my one tip would be find a group of people that you trust that you can be vulnerable with in your writing stage. And it doesn't have to be in person. The amount of workshopping I do with my friends over WhatsApp or Instagram or whatever, you know, like a messaging platform, just written.
Yeah.
If anything, just written is better because it's written down and then the person can just copy it and put it in their notes or whatever. I would say find a group of people that get your vibe and can help build on your joke that you know is good as a base, but you know has more in it, but maybe someone's perspective on it could add a difference. Like I did with my friend who said, "So what's the vibe of you waiting for your boo?" And
I think that's a really good tip. It seems like
the best one. But in terms of something quick and easy that they could do, I'd say stand still. Because a lot of people do this when they're performing. Yeah. You know, they're like rocking back and forth because you can tell they're unconfident. And if you hold, even if you're, you know, I move around a lot, but I'm walking, I feel like I'm presenting. I don't just hover on, you know, and that's probably, so yeah, those long term work with people to stand still. those are my two headlines.
I like those are good. Okay. And as you've already seen the first two episodes of this that were released, you probably know what's coming up next. The comedian's challenge I'm setting every comedian, if they choose to accept it, they can turn it down, but nobody has. So you could be the first.
I'm not going to be that person, am I? I'm emceeing it at the end of the month. So it's an MC challenge.
Yes, I guess it could well be. So for first time listeners, I'm holding up a book that you can't see because it's not a video. The Little Book of Shit Jokes by Sid Finch. And I'm challenging every comedian to pick one joke from this book, tell it live on stage. They can add the context they want to. They can adjust the joke if it's a little bit better. You know, if the joke talks about a daughter or something, make it a niece or something like that. However you want to adjust it. But the comedian gets to pick the joke. So it's their free choice. However, they get to pick it by the page number that it appears on. So exciting. To them, it's a mystery. And to me, it's a mystery. And then afterwards, to record it and post it on socials and tag us in it and stuff like that. So, Stacey, if you choose to accept a number between 5 and 95.
27. It's my lucky number for a reason that I can tell you.
Day of my birth as well.
Oh, well, mine. I was born on the 27th of the 7th, 87 at 2:27 in the morning, and I used to live at 127, and my mum was in labour with me for 27 hours and 27 minutes. Legit. When I was 27, it was an awful year. I always thought I might be one of the 27 club, but that didn't happen either. Thank God. 9 years later, she's still thriving.
Okay. Page 27 has two jokes on it, so you get to choose joke one or joke two.
Two.
Hello?
Don't know what. I'm two. Sorry. I just thought about that for way longer than I needed to. Joke two, please. I'll take joke
okay,
number two.
Okay, joke two. Okay, let me just read this so I can get the right context. Okay, the caretaker at my work climbed to the top of a big tree outside and invited me to join him. I refused. I don't get on with high maintenance people.
That's not that bad. That's okay.
The book it's not bad. I will send you a image of that so you can't forget it.
Yeah.
And I look forward to seeing that.
I'm already thinking of stuff. Because that'll just fold into a story. That'll just fold into one of my...
Yeah.
I'll find a way of folding that into a story. Speaking of high maintenance, have you met me?
I'm intrigued to see how people do that. Because if I've said to some, if you want to just say, I need to stop myself, I want to do this. I mean, set a challenge to make people laugh with this joke. Let's see if it works. They can try that. But I think it's always a little bit more fun to see if they can weave it into a story somewhere. And you never know, one joke out of this book may be good enough to become part of somebody's set full time. But I'm not holding out much hope.
I'm not sure if it's going to be a permanent feature, but maybe, and as I said, I think it's the obvious place to do those kind of jokes is like when you're emceeing, there's no narrative for my material so much when I'm emceeing. Yep. God, I never really thought about how much I have narrative, how much I'm like the narrative of my seven is so important to me, and that I don't do bits. Like I don't have like 2 minutes on that, 3 minutes on that. It's just all, which is actually quite stressful for like chopping bits out and adding bits in, I can honestly tell you.
Yeah, no, I kind of did that with my original story was just 5 to 7 minutes of stuff, and it all circled and led itself back to each other. But I did a 10 minutes back in December last year, and I've got two kind of sets, and I needed to intertwine them together to get the 10. And it worked by breaking down bits into sections.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than doing one set one followed by set two, I would do a section of set one followed by a section of set two that I could somehow tie together. And then I would get two of my keyest punchlines in there and always end up falling and finishing on the strongest one. But I still had the middle one that got people laughing that I thought was quite a strong joke. And then I ended up breaking
Kung Fu
down
fighting?
Things into sections. Kung Fu fighting is...
I know, it's like the Stacey's mum joke.
Such a shame.
Right? It's like the Stacey's mum joke. Like, if you're of an age, you get it. But if you're playing a room of Gen Z, they ain't getting that. They're just like... What's she talking about?
It's that, because there's that American guy who released the parody, isn't there, recently?
Oh, right. Yeah.
I can't remember what his name is, but I think it's brilliant. If nobody's listened to the parody of Stacey's Mum, you have to go and find it, because if you know the original song and then you listen to the parody, it's so well written. It really is. And yeah, I think that's another interesting thing before we kind of round up as such, is that the whole knowing your audience is quite a key thing. If you look round the room and go, everybody is under 25, there's no way I can say Kung Fu fighting, because it's just not going to work. It is going to fall flat. And because it's the last of a sequence of jokes, the last one should be the strongest one. And if the last one's the weakest one, it feels like you've just killed the room.
Yeah.
And it's demoralizing for you on stage, because you know in your heart of heart that if that room was 35 and upwards, it's going to win. It's going to work. But because of that age and the demographic, it's like if I can't remember the last time you saw me, is that the David Baddiel t-shirt.
I love that
t-shirt. I assessed the room before. But some people don't know who he is. And I've walked on stage before to pure silence.
People not chuckling.
And that, yeah. And when you don't, when I've done that joke 25 times and the every single time it lands, and every time it buys me a little bit of time on stage to compose myself as well. So it's kind of a little trick. I don't say a word. I compose myself. I'm getting the first laugh, and the audience are actually enjoying me before I open my mouth.
They're already like when warm they don't to get you. That,
yeah, but when they don't laugh, it's really off-putting.
Yeah,
and you're like, "What's my next line?"
Because you feel like you've got to say it
instantly.
It's the fear, the mind blank. And I think it's like what Kim was saying, that if you know your material backwards, then you can like play with it and chop stuff out. And I know some of my material backwards, the stuff I've been doing that's never left the five from the outset. But there's such a small amount of that at this point. But yeah, this is making me think of, I did one of my other bombing times that weren't proper. No, this was a proper bomb. Again, Chris was emceeing. I don't know why, like, me and Chris is, I don't know, he seems interwoven into it a little bit somehow. But anyway, I opened with, it was a room of older people, like not older people, not like my age and up, right? And comedy and like comedians, small group of them. Were you there? You might have been. It was at the Fox.
I haven't. No? The only time I've seen Chris perform was at Too Far Comedy.
Okay, well, fine then. So he was emceeing, and even he, like, everyone that went was getting very little from the audience. And I went out and I was recording myself, and I did the, like, you might know me from that song about my mum. And I looked around and it was like someone had died. Like, I was dying, and I was like, apparently not tonight. And then I kept moving on, but like, it was, I handled it well and just kept pushing through. And that was actually really character building for me, because I was like, okay, these are norms. And I thought they'd get this, but they like seemed intentionally to not want to have fun. It was so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it's an odd industry we're in at times, but it is literally so much fun when it goes well. The high of coming off that stage, knowing you smashed it and you've entertained people. And you go, yeah, that's my job done. I've got the buzz. I've got this adrenaline kick, and I know I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight because I'm going to be constantly going over it in my head.
I'm so tired all the time. Tired all the time because it is. I'm buzzing for ages, and even if stuff didn't go well, I'm still buzzing because it's like just in my head rattling around, and then you try and go to sleep. I struggle with sleep at the best of times anyway.
Same here.
Getting asleep, staying asleep, self-medicating in one way or another, without going into detail. I mean, like, I'm the kind of person that falls asleep watching Friends. And I know Friends is really problematic these days, but it's like, for me, it's like, it's like having nothing. It's like having friends there, like literal friends, not the TV show Friends. But yeah, it's all Frasier, quiet things. But yeah, it can be hard, and then suddenly that's when I'll, like, out of nowhere will suddenly start writing again, and like 20 minutes, half an hour goes, and it's like 2 a.m. and I'm like, I'll get up in like 6 hours, and because I'm writing, my brain's now again. So yeah, it's tricky. Having a job and doing comedy in the evenings is very tiring.
it can be a hard life balance as well, I think, at times. But okay, I think we can we'll wrap up around about there. I'll say thank you very much for coming on to this.
And thanks for having me,
entertaining us. If you can just let me know what your social links are, so
you can find me on Instagram, and apparently I use Facebook again now because it's the only way that you get comedy done. So, but I don't have a page or anything. It's just all of a sudden, like, Facebook has become a part of my life in a way that it hadn't been for years. So I'm on Instagram. I'm Stacey Edwards. I'm at Lestass, which is Lestass. It was a nickname from uni that stuck, and I'm not getting rid of it now. And yeah, I post my gig listings on there, and I do a bit of reels here and there, but I'm still in the early phases of trying to figure out how I want to be socially present. I guess.
Yeah. Cool. You can find us on openmiccomedypod.com. And our Instagram is openmiccomedypod. And whichever platform you are listening to us, then please do the follow, subscribe, etc., whichever one it is. If you want to leave us a 5-star review, I won't say no. But don't bother with 1, 2, 3, or 4 because they mean nothing. And until next time, if you're a comedian, keep being funny on the stage. And if you want to be a comedian, keep listening, get some hints, and come and join us on the stage. So until next time, take care of yourselves, and I'll speak to you all soon. Goodbye.